Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, Charles Lipsom, Khalil Marar, and Amir Yass. Our program tonight coming to you from the studios of WBEZ Radio. That's public radio in Chicago. That is our temporary home while our new radio studio is being built at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. You can be the first in your neighborhood to test the lines tonight. Our email address, brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a comment, send the tweet to @Dumo, @DUMO. We are going to continue this evening our discussion that began last week about the United States' role as it relates to ISIS and how we should respond to that threat. The president is going to have an address to the nation outlining his plan or his strategy. On Wednesday night, he will share that and talk about the role that Congress has to play, and also the role of alerting the American people to the challenges that lie ahead. Today, there was somewhat of a preview of that. He was the premier guest on Meet the Press today, hosted by its new moderator, Chuck Todd. And let me offer my congratulations. I have been an admirer of Chuck Todd for many, many years, and I think that he finally has the promotion that he has earned and deserved, and I thought he did a pretty good job in his maiden voyage at television's longest-running broadcast. So I would like to begin with a couple of our guests offering some assessment to what the president had to say today. And Charles Lipsom from the University of Chicago, you're somewhat of a conservative professor at a bastion of liberal political thought, so it is not uncommon for you to be uncomplimentary of the president. But how do you think he did today?
I thought that there was a seriousness about what he was saying today. I certainly think that he grasps how grave the danger is. By the same token, I felt like a lot of his remarks were designed for the American domestic audience, not to prepare them for serious fighting, but rather to reassure them that he wasn't going to do anything in terms of putting boots on the ground. He addressed a lot of things to Congress, and in the end, what he didn't tell us was whether he was willing to do anything in Syria or what his real strategy is.
Yeah, when asked the specific question, are you preparing the American people for war, he then avoided the direct answer to that question. Art Sear, you have been a watcher of this and previous presidents. Your reaction to the appearance this morning?
Well, Charles makes some very good points, as usual. I was sorry that the president singled out Syria for reiteration of criticism. At a time like this, when we're dealing with fundamental national security questions, just how desirable and pristine a particular domestic regime is becomes less relevant. We have a fundamental inconsistency in the sense that we have been opposing, quite rightly, extremist groups, including ISIS, much publicized in Iraq. At the same time, we're effectively supporting similar and sometimes identical groups in Syria. I don't think we can maintain this inconsistency forever.
Our other two guests this evening, Amir Yass is a former Iraqi soldier, a former Iraqi war POW during the first Gulf War. He came to the United States in 1992. He is a U.S. citizen, and he is a Muslim. Khalil Marar also joins us. He was born in Kuwait. He is a Palestinian, and he teaches at Governor's State and became a citizen in 2004. I give that background because I now want to hear from them to share with our audience. As new Americans who are talking about a region of the world that has dominated so much of our politics in this country for the last 15 years, Amir, let me turn to you first of all. What is the thing that you think the American people don't know about what's happening in your country and in that region of the world? What should we know that you know?
Well, first of all, Iraq, since the war, it's been divided. It's been broken. Since the invasion, they made the government. Now, before we used to know Saddam and his regime, and it's just Sunni, and they run the show. Now the prime minister Shia, the president Kurdish, the Sunni they pushed to the side. It's the country. It's broken. It's divided. It's vulnerable. It's easy to control. It's easy to for any terrorist group they can get in and do damage in the country more and more.
Is the country, in your view, better off today than it was under Saddam Hussein?
Well, I wasn't supportive of Saddam, but I wish he's back. It's a lot better. We used to have one Saddam. Now we have thousands of Saddams.
Khalil Morar, your reaction as a new American to what's happening in a part of the world that is near and dear to you.
I agree with Amir. It is a broken country, and I can't say that it's not something that was out of the purview of the Bush administration in the form of Dick Cheney. There was prior knowledge what would happen in Iraq once we invaded, or as quote-unquote Dick Cheney said, we go all the way in 1994, and that is Iraq would become broken, exactly as Amir describes it. Now, the real question is, what ought one do about it? We can't bring back Saddam Hussein, not that I would be or anybody on this table, would like that. I'm sure Amir would settle for it, but I'm not sure if he would like it. What I would emphasize is that we have to try not so much to unscramble this egg that is known as Iraq, but we have to work with the reality on the ground. And the reality is, it is a divided country. We have to figure out exactly how do we bring back a divided country into something that is unified and into a democracy, I dare say, that serves all of its people, not just the Shiocracy
but the way,
that's turned into.
The way it is now, Charles Lipson, the country is broken, but it has provided an opening not only for al-Qaeda, but certainly for ISIS and other more extreme elements that we would describe as radical Islamists.
You're absolutely right. We would describe them as radical Islamists, but the administration would not and does not use that word. The State Department doesn't use that word.
President, what about our other two guests? Would you describe that? You're a Muslim, Amir. Would you describe what ISIS represents is a form of radical Islam?
They're criminals. I mean, the country is already Muslim. They want to make them more Muslims. I don't understand what's their goal. They're criminals.
Their goal, I fear, according to ISIS's own leadership, including Baghdadi, is to literally cleanse the country of kafir, of people who basically don't share that faith. And Amir, you're absolutely right. They're already Muslims. I don't know what they're trying to accomplish. But I do know this. What they have said they're trying to accomplish is ethnically cleanse Iraq against all elements that are unsavory, beginning with the Shiites. And then,
how does that differ from Adolf Hitler, what his goal was?
These guys are, let's call them what they are. I mean, there's an old term that used to be used called Islamofascists, and they're very much fascistic in that respect, that they want to ethnically cleanse the country. Now, we have to understand that they are reacting to an extremist force known as Shiite extremism. And without that, without dealing with that, we can't really deal with ISIS.
So I want everybody to react, but we do have to break. 1-800-723-8289. I know I've said things that have perturbed Art Sear because of the raising of his eyebrows.
I'm always perturbed.
Well,
Bruce.
I know that you're perpetually the perpetually perturbed professor.
It's my mission in life. 1-800-723-8289
from coast to coast and border to border. Tonight from Navy Pier in Chicago.
Are you putting eyebrows on the ground?
From the Finger Lakes in upstate New York to Mackinac Island, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations and Sirius and XM satellite radio. Before the break, Charles Lipson, you were ready to jump in with something based on what Khalil had said.
I think that it's the case that we broke the country. I also think it's the case that toward the end of the Bush administration, after the Anbar awakening, the reversal of the Sunni tribes, and the U.S. surge, we had largely corrected the problem. The way that I see it is that there, by that point, we were kind of like a tent pole. The groups within Iraq didn't trust each other, but they had at least a minimum level of trust in the United States. What happened after the Obama administration came in was it abruptly withdrew the United States, withdrew all of its intelligence assets, which is why we were hit with a lot of this without knowing it, and created a lot of problems because the one thing they had to do was get a status of forces agreement, and they couldn't do it.
Art Sear, you also seemed perturbed at something that was said in the last segment that I had said.
You mentioned Hitler.
Well, I know, and I know you don't like me to drop that name, but what I—
No, not at all.
All right, well—
To respond to your question, I don't want to minimize the nature of the threat. There's not the equivalent of 80 million dedicated Germans behind ISIS. I do think we must be attentive to what kind of manpower they have, and the best— on the record, reports are it's somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000.
I was referencing the desire for purity. I mean, what we have here with the radical Islamists, they want pure,
Islam.
There
are lots of movements like that.
Right.
I thought you were the usual references to the tremendous power of the Third Reich.
No.
In terms of Iraq, the surge did work for a while. We did kill a lot of people. To do it, we also paid a lot of bribes. My understanding, and Thomas Ricks, a very serious, effective journalist, has written on this at length. My understanding is that Petraeus quite consciously and probably rightly paid people money to stay out of sight. And once the Americans and their money stopped, internecine strife reemerged. It's also important in fairness to the Obama administration. They're getting a lot of criticism tonight. The Iraqis insisted that we leave. Now, from the sidelines, whether you're the five of us, or Dick Cheney, kibitzing out of office, it's easy to criticize. But the Obama administration was not able to change that. The Iraqis told us they wanted us to leave.
But that, if I can respond to that for a second.
Sure, please do.
There was an election that was essentially a tie. And there was a long period, it was about 6 months, in which there was no Iraqi government formed. And the Obama administration decided not to play an active role in that. What happened out of that was that Nouri al-Maliki came in. He came in with a very strong agenda. And his agenda was used the central government as a Shiite militia on steroids. And what they did to the Sunnis then drove them into opposition, and that's what opened up. The issue here with ISIL coming in is that the Sunni militia have not opposed them. They just stood on the side. Why is that? Because they had no trust in whatever the government was in Baghdad.
Yes, sir. You had said before the broadcast that you have relatives that still live in Iraq.
Yes.
What do you hear from them? What do they tell you? What do they ask you?
Baghdad, it's mixed first.
And that's where they live, Baghdad.
Yes. A lot of Sunni, a lot of Shiites, a lot of Christians, all kind of people live in Baghdad. There is militias. There's Shia militias. There's a lot of the Sunnis are, I don't know how to describe them. They're like close to Al-Qaeda or I have no idea. But also they have, they do a criminal act in Baghdad, in the capital. It is divided. The government, Maliki, he divided the country pretty much. He made the Shia militias closer to him, support them, gave him a lot of weapons, and also he pushed the Sunni away, and that's what made it.
What is this question to you, and then I'll let others jump in, but in your view, because you identified yourself as a Muslim, what is the difference between the Shia and the Sunnis? Where do they split? And where are they together? Where are they united in what they believe?
Both of them, they believe in the same God, Allah, Muhammad, their prophet. Not much difference. It's like a Catholic and Protestants. Not much difference, actually.
Well, there's quite a bit of difference between Protestants and Catholics.
I agree with Amir that there really is not that much difference. I fear that the way that the politics have played out in the past, not just 40 or 50 years, but the past, 8 or 9 centuries, has been sort of rather, I can't put it any other way, but we have seen quite a bit of hostility between Shiite and Sunni only when the times become unhinged, only when there's a breakdown of a state apparatus like we did in Iraq, like we are having in Syria, and only when you have any majority that is being governed by a minority. Again, Iraq and Syria come into question here. And the truth is, the way to put those things back together and the way to allow those people, as exactly Amir is pointing out, of the same God and of the same beliefs, pretty much virtually the same, to live together is by not creating further schisms and is by allowing them to share in the political
resources. What justification do the radical Islamists – do you believe – is that a proper term for us to use?
Radical Islamist?
Do you agree with that? The White House doesn't use it. Republicans use it. Talk show hosts use it. This administration does not use that term. And David Cameron used it extensively.
Yeah.
Is it wrong for this president to not use that those terms?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the truth is this president was elected on the platform that we're going to reengage the Muslim world and that we're going to stop the wars in the Muslim world. And because we're going to reengage and stop the wars, yeah, this administration has been rather cautious about using terms that are pretty much full of hot air and rather sort of empty rhetoric. And the truth is, using the term is
why would that be empty rhetoric if you're describing one element? It would be like describing Christianity and assuming that, you know, that includes the Ku Klux Klan. I mean, there's a difference to the way that Christian leaders responded when their religion was being bastardized by the Ku Klux Klan.
You're absolutely correct.
And I'm saying who's standing up and who's defining that now? And if you have the President of the United States that can't even get those words out, is he being a good teacher of the American people about what the situation is over there?
There's other people that could be good teachers in that sense.
Like who?
I don't think it's – well, like, for example, the Republican senators that do use the term, like Bill O'Reilly, who does use the term, for example. Look, we have to be very careful here. The president has not only a moral obligation but a political responsibility to make sure that he does not use empty rhetoric. And it would be rather empty for him to just go, you know, with this rhetorical ploy of calling them Islamist or extremist if he's not going to do anything about it.
But where do you come in on just the use of this term and whether or not it is accurately portraying those in the world who want to do harm to the United States and want to kill Americans and people from the West.
I don't think that is their goal. I don't think we should become too preoccupied with terminology.
I agree.
It is a loaded term. I'm very glad you asked about David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, or quoted him. This is most effectively carried out, resistance to this terrible criminal group and others, most effectively carried out if we work with allies. In the op-ed I wrote for this week, I mentioned two NATO allies who are extremely important to our interests. One is Great Britain, led by David Cameron. The other is, of course, Germany, led by Angela Merkel. They've been two particularly effective and articulate NATO leaders, and we should be paying attention not so much to who uses what terminology, especially on a serious program
like
this.
What are they asking us to do? You say they're great leaders. What are they doing?
Well,
what have they done,
among other things, talking about what they're going to do, not just looking to Uncle Sam, and not just talking in terms of unilateral action, as we Americans tend to do.
And what are they going to do?
Angela Merkel is expanding, as is the government of Japan, quite rightly in my view, overseas operations by German military forces as well as civilian, including aid officials. David Cameron has been extremely inspiring, I think, a great motivating leader in terms of encouraging and, I believe, delivering greater NATO cohesion by emphasizing the terrible nature of this threat. I think both of them have done a great job. I do think Americans, like our predecessors, notably Winston Churchill and FDR during a much more difficult period, should think in terms of how can I be an effective alliance leader.
Cameron also did a brilliant job, I thought, in his speech last week, in that he zeroed in and I think accurately defined the radical Islamist elements. And those were terms that he did use as a leader of the world as well.
Well, they
he used that, but he put it in context to the bigger, broader Muslim community around the world, which he said is a religion of peace. He was able to separate out the radicals from the religion.
Well, they had,
and I don't know
put.
Whether there's enough of that discussion going on.
Well put, Bruce.
They had just paid this huge price in England, which we haven't noticed here, that 1,400 children had been raped in northern England by Pakistani immigrant men, and the police knew about it and essentially covered it up because they didn't want to inflame that local community. That's a big story in England. I think that simply...
Before you tell us what you think simply, because that usually is a couple of minutes, we do have to pause. 1-800-723-8209 from coast to coast and border to border. There is a call on the line. We will engage with them when we continue. From WBEZ Radio, the public radio station in Chicago tonight, our temporary home, while our new home is being fixed. Live from Navy Pier in Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us around the roundtable this evening, and it is a semi-roundtable tonight. And we're going to let each of our guests introduce themselves, say a little bit about who they are and why they're here. And we're going to start with our good friend Art Sear, who has been on this program probably for over 20 years.
Could be, Bruce. Thank you very much for inviting me
back.
And
tell everybody who you are.
I'm Art Sear. I teach at Carthage College. I work at the Clausen Center. Carthage is a very fine liberal arts college just across the state line in Kenosha. I work at the Clausen Center for World Business. Tom Clausen is one of our graduates who went on to considerable impressive success as head of Bank of America twice in better days and better bankers, in my opinion, and he ran the World Bank in between.
Charles Lipson also joins us.
I'm from the University of Chicago, originally born and raised in Mississippi. And Art undersold what he's done at Carthage. He's really created an important center for the study of international political economy, the politics of the world economy at Carthage. And he deserves a heck of a lot of credit, especially from those of us who work in the same field as I do down at the University of Chicago.
Very good. Khalil Morar.
I'm Khalil Morar. I'm from Governor State University. This year we're accepting our first freshman class. We're actually becoming a four-year university for the first time in history, so it's very exciting there. I'm working on a couple of publications right now. One is on terrorism, jihadi terrorists, how they become the way that they become. Another publication I'm considering is possibly an op-ed called The Way Out of Iraq is Through Syria and Iran. And meanwhile, I'm working on a book called Middle East Conflicts, The Basics.
And you're a Palestinian?
Yeah.
From Kuwait?
From Kuwait, uh-huh.
And how did you get to the United States?
We made it here in 1987, and we landed in New York City.
Amir Yass joins us. Amir, tell us about yourself.
My name is Amir Yass. I came to this country in 92, originally from Iraq. I was a POW from 91, the Desert Storm. I'm a barber. I own my own shop. In Chicago.
How do we, I want to go back, I'd like to sort of put what has already taken place, I'd like to put that in the rearview mirror, if I can, mm-hmm. and talk about what do we do now. You've described at the beginning of the broadcast that the country of your birth, it's broken. It's a broken country. It has spawned a anti-West, I'll use the term radical Islamist group, sect, if you will, that is scaring the bejesus out of a lot of people all over the world, those in Western Europe, those in the United States. It has been described by the head of the FBI, by the CIA, by all the leadership of our intelligence agencies as a very fearful entity that's out there, more powerful, more wealthy, with greater reach than Al-Qaeda ever had. So it has scared the world, and the beheading of two journalists have only made that more well known. And the level of their brutality is now on stage. My question to you is: what do we do? When I say we now, we're all Americans now. What do we do to unbreak the country and rid the world of this threat that wants to ruin our lives or kill us?
In the United States, they're talking about bombing ISIS in Iraq. People, they may be going to be happy, but it's not enough, I think. to get rid of them. There's a lot of things, and from ISIS, they come from outside the country. United States, they need to force those countries to stop, send them to Syria and Iraq. They are killing innocent people. I wanted to know who fund those people, who give them weapons, who give them those brand new pickup trucks. Where's the money come from? It's got to be some countries. And
well, first, they control some oil fields now.
I'm talking about before they come to Iraq.
What is your answer? You asked a question, but I think you probably know the answer.
Of course, yeah.
Who are they? Let's name names.
For sure, Saudi Arabia, the biggest country who send those people. The Prince Bandar, those are his guys. He put them in power. He give them weapons. He send them. There's a lot of in UK until this day they recruit those people openly in the street in every mosque. There's a lot of Americans go from here go and fight over there. One thing I wanted to know is it really like they wanted to spread Islam or they want to just fund, just go kill and we get paid for it. I wanted to know that.
I think the people who are going from Minneapolis are true believers. By the way, it's important that Khalil spoke of jihadi terrorists. That's another term that's been ruled off the table. We've been told that even using the term jihad is something we shouldn't do because it also means personal struggle. And so we shouldn't do it, and it identifies with I think you can't deal with these issues unless you face them squarely without blinkers and try to address them. You shouldn't be trying to demean a religion, and certainly not a whole religion, but it's important to recognize that the people who are doing this fighting have religious ideologies. It's not just that they're from
Khalil, to you, how do we get to those? How do we cut off the head of radical Islam? And I'm going to continue to use that term.
Yeah.
How do we cut that head off? And what happens if we do? I mean, does it instantly? Are people ready to step in?
Yeah, there are three points that I would answer with. The first is that we have to end the extremism in the region in all of its forms, and I can elaborate further on those. The second is we have to allow for the formation of truly democratic regimes throughout the Middle East. You know, this is a region that truly lacks in democracy. We have to counter the lack of democracy with conditioning all of our actions in that region towards ones that are aimed at allowing democracies to exist.
These are things that take time.
They do.
I want to talk about the specifics of what can we be doing now, whether it is militarily, whether it is political, or whether it is economic, or as you say, putting the screws on the Saudis to stop funding. What can we do now so that 1 year from now or 6 months from now, we could say that ISIS is on the decline, just as the president has said that Al-Qaeda is on the decline?
Bruce, that's a great question. And the answer to it is that we have to signal that our actions are aimed at creating countries in the Middle East that are more inclusive of all people, not just some of the people. What our actions have suggested, for example, with us tearing down Iraq and rebuilding the new Iraq, is that we're privileging some people in the Middle East over other people. In this case, the Shiites of Iraq were privileged at the expense of Sunnis and all others, by the way. Christians have fled Iraq in droves as a result of the regime in Baghdad.
Art, same question to you. What, from a practical standpoint, something that the people who are listening to this program can clearly understand, what are the steps that need to be taken to protect American interests and lives in this climate where there is great fear that ISIS is coming to America to, again, as we near the celebration, or not the commemoration, rather, of 9/11. People are worried about whether they're going to be blown up or have their heads cut off.
We certainly have to pursue the military dimension as effectively as possible to capture, kill, otherwise neutralize terrorists, and we've been emphasizing that this evening. We also have to attend to the economic dimension, as this country has pretty skillfully since before we were directly involved in World War II. The more there is economic development and pressure for wide participation, especially the crucial participation of women in this part of the world as in others, the better. Finally, we have to remain mindful, and I hope the president will talk about this more publicly, that in the economic dimension, we are becoming dramatically and very quickly not only self-sufficient in oil and natural gas. We've been highly dependent since about 1960 on imports, as people know. We are becoming self-sufficient. We're already a major exporter of gasoline. That gives us tremendous leverage in the Middle East, with Russia, elsewhere in the world.
We're going to take a call. Let's go to Joe, listening to us in Waukegan, Illinois. Good evening, Joe. You're on the air.
Good evening. Yeah, I have a question. I understand that Sharia law does not distinguish between combatants and non-combatants in warfare. That is, there's no difference between a civilian and a soldier. Is that true?
No, it's not true.
Khalil says that's not true. Where did you hear that, Joe?
Pulled it off of YouTube. An expert, a Muslim, was being interviewed on some show, and this is what he said, that there is no difference between the combatant and non-combatant.
All right, thank you. We had an answer at least from one of our guests. Let's go to Charles, listening to us on driving on WLS. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, Bruce, this is Glenn. My name's Glenn.
Oh, Glenn, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm on I-55. I just wanted to call to say I think we need to have a more honest discussion about the fundamental nature of Islam itself. And I'm saying that based on what I know of Islamic history going back to the time of Muhammad. We know that not much of the Middle East was Christianized at that time. However, when the Islamic armies arose, they basically tried to commit genocide against the Christian population.
No, they didn't.
And that is how the entire Middle East and Turkey, for a good example there, Turkey's a prime example, became Islamized. My objection is politically correct talk show hosts attributing the term radical Islam to groups like ISIS. To me, if they are following the example of their prophet, they aren't radical at all. They're doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And I would term ISIS as being good Muslims. They're doing what they are have been taught to do.
Glenn, you have asked a bombshell question. We're about to go to a break. Khalil was shaking his head as you were speaking. We will get his response to your definition of Muslim thoughts when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. And then I want to focus, guys, again, what do we do next? What do we do next? I'm Bruce Dumont. I'm back in Chicago, and Khalil, you wanted to comment on the last caller.
I would say to Glenn's call, it's really disgraceful. If you substitute the word, any word, instead of Muslim, whether it's Jewish or Christian, people would recoil in horror. What he said is truly grounds almost like you can kill a Muslim without anybody caring. And what he said is not only anti-Semitic and Islamophobic, but ultimately opens a way and the door to genocide. And we have to be very careful to basically condemn people like that and condemn their hate-filled message.
Let's take another call. Chris in Palatine, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Yes, Bruce. I recall when you were on WLS when you had Tom Roser and
yes.
You know, back in the early 90s. So,
yep. We're in our 34th year, my friend, 34
back,
years on this
back,
show.
And I've been listening to you for about 34 years.
Well, good.
So back home again. Anyway, how do you trust, you know, looking for allies to fight, you know, these guys, you know, these Islamists? I mean, 2 years ago and last year, John McCain had his arms around the leaders of these ISIS the murderers, butchers, because they were fighting against Assad in Syria, and he was saying that they were our kind of guys. And nobody, of course, is telling, you know, nobody's reminding McCain of that. So, you know, how do you pick a winner in there? How do you pick a horse to play because, you know, I don't trust any of them.
Well, that, Charles, this is an excellent point. Obviously, the quick response is trust but verify, which is to say don't trust at all. We have a notion of allies that's built around NATO, which is the most unusual alliance in world history. Most alliances are tactical and short-term for specific things. But I think you're quite right in saying, for example, the Saudis may be our allies on some of this stuff, but they're also sponsoring quite extreme madrasas all over the world from which a lot of these extremists are actually being recruited. Not that the Saudis want that necessarily, but they're promoting it. We are often now on the same side as Iran. You have tactical alliances around specific things, and you must be concerned, as Chris says, about whether the munitions you give and support you give could end up going to the wrong people.
Thank you very much for your call. Charles, you and I had lunch last week with our good friend Dave Lundy, and in the course of this discussion, and there were a number of people in the room, as it relates to why European nations are maybe even more fearful than ISIS than the United States, because their homeland is closer and maybe may not have all the sophisticated devices used to protect people. So, although certainly London and England are remarkable in the surveillance that they provide, and knowing that the cauldron of anti-West hatred, much of it is coming out of London as well as other capitals of the world. And you were talking about the spread of anti-Semitism, and you basically had described the way in which the world media had not really given that its proper due, if I've summarized your comment. And I'm wondering what you could say about that, and where does that fit into this growing concern that Western Europe has about their inability for those that are coming to their countries to assimilate and become, you know, French as opposed to, you know, radical Islamists that may live in France?
This is an important question because in the and one that's hard for Americans to understand, because essentially we don't have anti-Semitism in any large measure, and certainly not politically important in the United States. But in Europe, the right, which was traditionally identified as a very kind of extreme version of sword, altar, and altar meaning the right wing of the Catholic Church, has always had a strong anti-Semitic dimension. What's different now is that the left is so openly anti-Semitic, and that they are joined by very large numbers of Muslims. Muslims who've immigrated to Europe, march through the streets wearing shirts saying "send the Jews to the gas chambers." And these are the kinds of things that are now said about Jews in Europe are genuinely frightening. And it's become a major, major problem. You're beginning to get – there are Jews fleeing France. There are Jews fleeing – there are no Jews who live in Malmo, Sweden anymore, because you would be assaulted by Muslims who live in Sweden, who feel like you can just beat up any Jew who lives there.
Khalil, can you offer any assessment of that? Have you acknowledged that that might exist, what Charles has described?
Look, I mean, there is definitely an anti-Jewish sentiment in Europe. I would not disagree with anything that Charles said, except to say that Muslims and Jews face the same common enemy. The European right-wingers that hate on Jewish people also hate on Muslim people. They hate Muslims for the same reason that they hate Jews. It is because they're not being perceived as European or thoroughly European or non-assimilated. The same thing that is being said about Muslims today in Europe by the far right-wing parties used to be said about Jews right before Adolf Hitler came to ascendancy. So we have to form a united front here, and we have to be careful to be able to parse out right-wing terrorist mentalities in Europe from those of Muslims that do those deplorable acts. If you ask most Muslims about Jews, they will say they're brothers in common faith. If you were to talk to radicals about Jews, of course they would hate Jews, just as radical Jews would hate Muslims.
On that note, we are out of time for hour number one. I thank everybody for being with us. And we also want to thank a special Thank you, and a farewell to Amir Yass, who has joined us in hour number one for our discussion of Iraq and ISIS. And in hour number two, we're going to be switching gears and talking about another part of the world that also has quite a bit of focus on it, and that is Russia. And again, from coast to coast and border to border, we will continue to take your phone calls. But when we come back on the other side of Network News, wherever you're listening to this broadcast this evening, we'll be switching gears and talking about Russia and its future, and most importantly, its role in the world as it relates to the United States foreign policy. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear from Carthage College, Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, Khalil Marar from Governor State University, and joining us from California, Nigel Rabb, a Russian expert at Loyola Marymount University. Our program tonight coming to you from the studios of Public Radio WBEZ in Chicago, which is our temporary home while our new studios are being constructed at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, and hopefully everything will be ready next week. We knock on Formica, and our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. I'm happy to report that they are working this evening. 1-800-723-8289, our email address, brucedumont@museum.tv, and if you want to tweet us a comment or question, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. In our first hour, we were talking about Iraq, we were talking about Syria, we were talking about ISIS, although we didn't talk too much about Syria. We talked about the president's address to the nation on Wednesday night, talking about the ISIS threat and what the intention of the United States is going to be. So I would suspect that that will be once again a topic of discussion in our broadcast next week. But for the last 6 months, another very important hotspot in the world has revolved around the actions of Russia and Vladimir Putin. And we are now joined by this evening by Nigel Rabb, who, as you will recall, earlier in the year when we were doing our broadcast from California, became a frequent voice on this program. He is a political science professor specializing in Russian history at Loyola Marymount University. And, Nigel, nice to have you back on Beyond the Beltway.
Nice to be back, Bruce. Thanks.
When we were having a problem a couple of weeks ago when we had no phone calls available to us, you were coincidentally in Moscow. And I missed the opportunity of having a live report from Moscow during the a pivotal moment in Putin's push in Ukraine. So I'm sorry I missed that. But let me ask you, at this moment in time, how would you describe the Putin strategy, if indeed there is a strategy? And is he winning in this worldwide battle for recognition and to revive the stature worldwide of Russia?
Yeah, well, I think in terms of his strategy, I think the strategy is very similar to what we saw in April in Ukraine. And it's just unsettling, keeping Ukraine unsettled, because at some point, the economy is just not going to be able to hold up with this. So that's one problem. In terms of winning globally, I think there are a number of things they did, such as the humanitarian convoy they sent into Ukraine. But it doesn't really fool. I don't think this is fooling the world. I think they know what's up, and they can see through a lot of this. And it's still very much the areas of concern are very much areas which have a large Russian concentration of people. So
last week on this program, I said that in my view, Vladimir Putin had really surpassed Barack Obama and was really controlling the world stage. Do you agree with that assessment?
No, I wouldn't agree. I wouldn't agree with that, because I think one of the things with Russia today, which is very different from Russia, say, as the Cold War in the 1970s, is the influence it's exerting the strong influence is really only on its borders. And so, for example, with the China on its in the Far East, on its southern border there, I don't think Russia is anywhere close to pushing China around or anything like that. And so I don't think on a world stage, no. I think in a European stage, then maybe. Even then, I'm not.
Nigel, these are very
smart. This is Charles Lipson speaking.
These are very smart comments. I've been on with you before, and I'm really delighted to be on now. I was in Beijing when the deal with Moscow was announced, Moscow to become, in effect, their pipeline. And I think you're absolutely right. And when you talk to people in Beijing or foreign policy experts, I think that they have they're very wary of what Putin is doing, and in particular what they're wary of is that they think that Russia has missed its chance, that you become a strong power in the end by having a strong economy, as China has tried to do since Deng Xiaoping.
Art Sear, could you weigh in on what Nigel has said? And you are also a longtime observer of Russian politics.
Yes, but I'm not an expert. I think his comments are insightful as well as sensible. Putin did quite recently reach a major energy agreement with China, which Russia desperately needs. It was a way, I think, of showing that Russia is more than just a European player, but in fact, and this gets back to the strength that we have in this vital resource field, they really do need as much business as they can generate related to their capacity of electric and other kinds of power generation.
They also,
have the sanctions worked in any significant way, Nigel? That the United States and the West have imposed?
I think one measure, if you look over the summer, the ruble dropped about 10% in about a month, I think. In a very short period of time, the ruble dropped its value. I think the other part of the sanctions, I think in terms of, because I was in Moscow in the summer, and if you're looking around and you're seeing what people spend and you're talking to people, I don't think the sanctions made a difference there. But I think what's happening, and this I think they'll be very effective, is Russia, in a sense, is turning in on itself. So, for example, import of foreign cars, it's like, who needs a Mercedes? They're not good anyway. We can drive a Lada. And so then this sounds very Soviet. And so I think over the long term, they will have a very strong effect, yes.
And immensely, he's still immensely popular with his people.
Yeah, and I think part of that, again, it's very instructive. Being in Moscow and talking to people, and it's like, you know, the Crimean, just regular people on the street, the Crimean Peninsula is ours, Putin got it back, Donetsk is a Russian city, Ukrainians have no interest in there, Putin's getting it back for us. And so you get this, but the other part of this, and this is for me very instructive when I was in Moscow, is watching the Russian news at night. And, you know, there are, like, we have five different news channels, but it tends to be that you're just switching from the same story to the next.
Yeah. What do they want? If his past actions have led to his bump in polls, and all politicians like to look and see those polls going up, what do they want next? What does he want next? What's on his bucket list?
I would say the number one is to solve this Ukrainian crisis in a way that is favorable not only to Russia, but to, again, because our Russian nationalists, whose voices are getting louder and louder, louder and louder, but to the Russian nationalist agenda. And that's why Ukraine, because we also hear about Latvia and Estonia, Ukraine is so much more important than the Baltic states in the mindset not only of Putin, but of most Russians.
So we should not worry that he's going to march someplace else. Other former states of the Soviet Union, they shouldn't be worried in the Baltics or Poland or any place else that he's going to keep marching towards them.
I think they should be. I certainly think they should be worried, but I think that is much, much less likely.
Art, do you agree with that?
Yes, I also think it's extremely important and very positive that NATO is developing a rapid reaction force and plans to deploy them in the states we've been discussing. Poland, which is an important and pivotal NATO member, historically as well as currently pivotal, there'll be military exercises there later on this fall, and the British Prime Minister emphasized the importance of that fact.
We've got to pause. When we come back, Nigel and the rest of our panel, we're going to hear from Khalil Mirar, and I want to talk about Russia's role or influence at all if it has influence in the Middle East. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8289. Nigel Rabb is joining us from his home in California. And let me begin this portion. I also want to mention that Khalil Morar is with us from Governor State University and a graduate of Loyola University in Chicago as well. But you're with Loyola Marymount, Nigel. My question before the break was, what role does Russia play in the Middle East today?
I would say it plays the role of a classic sort of large, almost imperial state that wants to have an influence in decisions that are made around the world. It's not like in the Soviet Union where there was this ideology that was backing whatever the Soviets did. So in the terms of the Russian influence, there's weapon sales. That's a very big one. And it's something to be concerned about.
Who are they providing their weapons to?
Like places like Syria and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that is.
What about the Iran connection? Could you say something about that?
About the Iran connection? Well, I think with Iran, again, this may be more close to the Soviet, is with the nuclear weapon sales and that. Sorry, not nuclear weapon sales, but
nuclear reactors.
Helping with the development of nuclear technology, so that's better said. That is another issue there. And I think in the broad scope of things, we're just seeing Russia reassert itself wherever it had reasserted itself in the Cold War, now that it's back on its feet. And I think what we'll also see is that domestically there'll be a price to be paid for the Russian population.
Is Russia, in your view, Khalil, where is Russia in the Palestinian Israeli battle?
You know, that's an important question, Bruce, and I'm glad that Nigel is giving us this kind of insight. The Russians have traditionally acted as spoilers to the American approach to the region simply because they want their cut of the action on the region. And look, there's two tragedies taking place with what's going on between Russia and the Ukraine. The first is that it's a major violation. It is a supreme violation of the Budapest understanding, of the Budapest memorandum that we reached with the Russians, that the Ukrainians reached with the Russians in 1990, that basically said that Ukraine will give up its nuclear weapons in order to have its borders secure by all parties involved, especially in this case, Russia. The second reason that it's a tragedy, and it's really a heartbreaking calamity, is because the Russians are supposed to be helping us on Syria. They're supposed to be helping us on Iran. They're supposed to be helping us sort of defuse the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And instead now, you know, what we have, and even on the space program, for God's sake, what we have now is us telling the Russians, no, 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 you cannot do this on the one hand. And on the other hand, they're just kind of laughing at us because they know how much we need them in terms of Iranian nukes, in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, in terms of Assad's massacre of his population.
What do you think of that, Nigel?
Oh, I would agree. I would agree with most of that. I don't, I guess, in thinking about it, the one thing I would add is that, you know, the Russians are laughing at us. I'm not sure they're very serious, you know, like Lavrov and all the rest. Right. I mean, they're very serious international players. I just think if they are laughing at us, it is, and I think that's what's going to happen, and this is the Soviet experience, it will be at the expense of their own domestic economy. This is not sustainable long term, and then we can expect maybe, you know, what we saw again in 1991.
We have a very confused foreign policy there. It's important to say what the crucial background of all this is. They had essentially a puppet regime in Kiev. The people, independently of Western and U.S., rose up and overthrew it. When that happened, Putin decided to take other actions, and he moved into ethnically Russian areas. And just as in other areas of the world where the administration was caught flat-footed and essentially developed no strategy, we still have no strategy in Ukraine. There's one to be developed there, but it has to be very carefully done because you don't want to provoke a nuclear power, and at the same time, you want to really set red lines, not the kind of red lines that were set in Syria.
Do you agree, Art, that we don't really have a strategy, that this
foreign policy of the Obama administration is as inept and as moronic as the professor has suggested?
I don't think he said it was moronic on the air.
Off the air he did.
Well, the president, if I were trying to be cute, I could quote the president saying we don't have a strategy yet.
On ISIS.
That's one reason he's been, well, I think he was.
But it resonated because people thought it was true about China, it was true about Iran, it was true about Ukraine.
I think it was the wrong thing to say, and it was inadvertently revealing. The Russians have taken the initiative in a range of areas, including natural resources in the Arctic. And I agree primarily with the other speakers that it's been a lack of initiative on our part.
The Obama administration is as limited as the Bush administration was when Putin was running roughshod over Georgia. We're not doing much about Ukraine. Actually, I would add that the Obama administration did more about the Ukraine issue than the Bush administration did about Georgia. Now, look, this is not about who did what, when, and how. This is precisely about what should be done going forward. Is the Obama administration, did it have the best policy possible? Well, no. We should have known, for example.
What is our policy going forward on this, this administration?
I'm not going to be in the unsavory position of defending the Obama administration. What I will say is this. There are three things that need to be done with the Russian-Ukrainian issue. The first thing is that we need to notch up the sanctions. We need to engage in more serious sanctions and show the Russians that we're serious about this. We need to have forward. The second thing is that we need to have forward deployment of NATO. And essentially, with the allies, the NATO allies that are in the Baltic, in Poland and so on, we need to have forward operating bases immediately. And the third thing that we need to do is we need to basically have back-channel talks with Russia about what their end game is. And we need to essentially try to, you know, give a little so that they can secure the peace in that part of the world.
Art,
it's a very unsavory part of the
world. What came out of the meeting last week, the NATO summit that the president went to? What, in your view, how do you read what came out of that, and how does it affect not only, we talked about ISIS in the first hour, but again, it was also dealing with the issue of Russia as well.
Well, Khalil emphasized it rightly, a forward deployment force that will be in current NATO members, most crucially, I think, Poland, which isn't discussed as much as the Baltic states. France agreed to withdraw from a much-publicized warship deal with Russia, a greater sense of unity, which I think, again, the British Prime Minister and the German Chancellor personify. This is no small accomplishment. Throughout the life of NATO, there has been a constant struggle to maintain some semblance of unity. I think Charles quite rightly described that. Things have been far worse during the Cold War than they are currently regarding NATO.
Finally,
you were good enough to ask me, the Bush administration, quite unwisely and very recklessly, in my view, tried to get both Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, starting in 2004. And the Russian army very promptly invaded parts of Georgia in 2008.
Nigel?
I would agree with that. I think the NATO issue, and I think, you know, listening to what Putin said, and this is after the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula, he was talking about Sevastopol, and Sevastopol is the big Russian naval base on the Crimean Peninsula, and he was basically saying, if Ukraine becomes part of NATO, Sevastopol becomes part of Ukraine, and therefore you could potentially have a NATO meeting in Sevastopol. And his comment was, you know what, it's better that we invite them to visit us in Sevastopol than they invite us to visit us in Sevastopol. And that, I think, for Russians, that just resonates. And the other one about Ukraine is there. I mean, Poland does not have a substantial Russian population. Poland has no area where the Russians think these are our historical roots. So Ukraine is very, very different. And then the other one, if I could just add, with the NATO meeting, because I always think of the photo of Poroshenko with all these Western leaders and everybody saying, we'll support Poroshenko, but you know, Poroshenko's from Ukraine. His business interests are with Russia, and that's the environment he's grown up. So I think there is a risk that we exaggerate how much Ukraine is actually Western-leaning.
And also, again, getting back to the new leader, again, he also felt that part of his motivation was that he felt that he'd gotten screwed on a deal with the Russians, and so part of his political activity is sort of a retaliation against what he thought was a bad end of a business deal. Is that correct? Have I summarized that?
Yeah, if you're thinking of him personally, yes. He had he's the big chocolate baron. And in fact, I think it was his Vestia today, which is just pointing out, you know, Ukrainian candies are disappearing from the shelves.
Right.
From the shelves of
Russia. They took his chocolate off the shelves in Moscow, and he got PO'd about it.
I'm glad that there's been movement, and Art is right in saying that it's very hard to get these countries to move together. I would just say that a few thousand people in a fast deployment force is pretty thin gruel, and I'll tell you why. The reason that you want those NATO troops on the front lines is essentially as tripwires.
Yes.
They're there to tell the Russians in a credible way, if you go in, you'll inevitably kill Americans, and because you'll kill or capture Americans, we will respond. You know we will. And having a group of people who can get on a plane and be there 2 days later doesn't perform that function.
Nigel, last question to you. Do you believe that Russia is an active participant in trying to root out worldwide terrorism?
Oh, that's a big question with about, you know, 30 seconds to go.
Right.
an activist, I would say, in the past more so than it is now, because it has always traditionally had a big interest. I mean, and we forget this, because of all the Chechenian the incidents in Chechnya at the end of the 90s, there were a lot of terrorist incidents in Moscow. And so in the Bush administration, when they had these discussions, Putin's legitimately interested in rooting out terrorism.
Nigel, we have to say farewell with you at that particular point. We're going to be back in California in the next several weeks. So we look forward to seeing you face-to-face from your perch at Loyola Marymount University. When we come back, our guests in Chicago will continue, and we will move to another part of the world, the Palestinian-Israeli standoff. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us from coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. For those listening within the sound of my voice in Chicago, a museum plug here that on the 19th of September, Larry King will be at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. He's going to be interviewed by his good friend Charlie Steiner, also a member of the Radio Hall of Fame, one of the voices of the Los Angeles Dodgers. They will be in town that day. Larry will be throwing out the first pitch at Wrigley Field, and that night at 7 o'clock, an opportunity to meet Larry King live in person at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. You can go to our website, which is museum.tv, and order your tickets. They're $25, and we invite you to do so. An evening with Larry King in Chicago. Then he's off to Mexico City. This is the busiest 81-year-old man in the world.
I used to love him on those late-night radio shows.
He was terrific.
He was terrific on that, and he was a great storyteller.
He's a great story, and he has perhaps one of the best voices in the history of radio. But anyway, he will be there live. Good friend of the museums. Come on down and meet Larry King. Doesn't come to Chicago a lot, so if you want to bring your friends or neighbors or aunts, uncles, grandmothers, grandfathers, whatever it is, come on down and see Larry King September 19th, and museum.tv is the place to go. I said before the break that we had talked about ISIS, we had talked about Iraq, we had talked about Syria, we talked about Russia, and we have people on opposite sides of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict who are in the studio this evening. So I want to take the last half hour to talk about what is likely to happen there next. And I want to begin not so much looking in the rearview mirror, but what next there. So, Khalil, let me talk about you, ask you first. You are a Palestinian. What is next there? What's the next thing to happen of consequence in that region of the world?
You know, what is next, if we look at the past, historically what is next is going to be based on the past. I don't see a way out of this impasse. I see the Israelis attacking Gaza in the future in order to dislodge and further defeat Hamas, degrade Hamas, and so on and so forth. I see the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank begging the Israeli for a two-state solution, which is what's in the interest of the Israelis, what's in the interest of the Palestinians, what we said in the United States of America we wanted, what the Europeans have said they wanted. And I see the Israelis basically not following through with that. And the reason they're not following through with that is because what we have on the ground in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is an asymmetric situation. The Palestinians cannot defend themselves. The Israelis, I fear, and I say sadly, in many cases, hold all the cards, including the Trump card, which is being able to make peace. The only way to make peace is through a two-state solution, which the international community wants and everybody on the table wants.
Charles Lipson, let me ask you the same question and get your perspective. What's next?
I think that the first thing is whether or not there will be a split between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. They are in a unity government right now. They form the unity government between the two of them, and then the and then Hamas started attacking the Israelis. When they did that and the Israelis responded, and Hamas was essentially defeated but not completely uprooted, it opened a possibility for Fatah, which essentially governs the West Bank, to separate, and it looks like that will be the next thing that happens.
As you were speaking, Khalil was shaking his head no. Where was Charles' interpretation wrong in your view?
He was wrong when he says that Israel is responding to this or that. The best way that Israel can respond to Hamas is by defeating Hamas politically, and the best way to defeat Hamas politically is through a two-state solution. If the Israelis do not allow the Palestinians to have the two-state solution that the West Bank Authority is begging for, then there will not be peace in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, not just because of the siege, as Hamas calls it, but ultimately because the Palestinians live under occupation and the Israeli settlements have essentially gobbled up what's left of the Palestinian state.
If there is a two-state solution, this question to you, Art Sear, if there is a two-state solution that ultimately happens, who gets what and who has to give up what?
I think both sides have to give up a lot. We don't know the borders of a viable two-state solution. Gaza represents real progress in that direction. I think the most constructive thing I might say as a non-expert on that region as well is that there is an opportunity here given this ceasefire that's held now for a while. I think Israel, which has a right to self-defense, achieved a lot of their objectives in this offensive against reaction against Hamas terrorism. I think we should look for American leadership, and I admire John Kerry's dedication and energy to this task. And I think we should be fairly relaxed about problems between Israel and the United States when we've had great progress in that region during the George H.W. Bush administration, which led to the quasi-independent authority in Gaza during the Carter administration with Camp David, during the Eisenhower administration when we made perhaps the greatest progress of all. There have been lots of disagreements between Israel and the U.S.
Charles,
I would say the disagreements right now are pretty substantial. But the problem for the Israelis on the two-state solution is not just the borders and some of the rights of return and all those issues. They have to be assured that whatever state goes in won't be firing missiles at their international airport and so forth, from which they'll be a few miles away. So there's a serious problem there. But I would just say that Hamas faces a very serious problem now. They just took a ceasefire deal that was on the table after the first week of war. They had 50 days of war, got 45 more days in effect of killing and all the rest for nothing. When did it all stop? It all stopped when Israel started targeting their most senior leaders and bombed a few of the high-profile apartment buildings in which the wealthier, more connected Gazans lived. The issue of the tunnels is also a big deal because those tunnels were not smuggling tunnels. These were tunnels that were designed to bring in terrorists into Israel to kidnap Israelis or stage a 9/11 type attack
within
Israel.
Would you acknowledge that, Khalil, that that's the purpose of the tunnels?
Hamas is a terrorist organization, so I wouldn't trust it with any tunnels.
Right. So, and
so you
govern.
So you agree. That, you
that's
you
an
agree.
Important area of agreement.
You agree that the Israeli destruction of the tunnels is a positive thing that needs to be done.
As long as the Israelis allow the people of Gaza to import things like penicillin, then yeah, the tunnels should be destroyed. The problem right now, Bruce, is not with the tunnels. The problem is with the motivation for the tunnels. The reason that the Palestinians have built tunnels across Rafah and across the West Bank into the West Bank or into Israeli territory is because they're smuggling primarily foodstuffs and other things into the Gaza Strip. Now, along with that is weapons, but that speaks to my earlier point about discrediting and disproving Hamas. Most Palestinians do not agree with Hamas. Most Palestinians hate Hamas. The question is, Why is Hamas still in power? And the only answer is it's because of the screwed up politics that are taking place in the region, the Palestinians not having a two-state solution, which was promised to them, mind you, by 2005.
And the corruption,
it is now time for a two-state
and the corruption
solution.
Of the Palestinians.
Why don't we have a two-state solution?
We don't have a two-state solution, I think, because Israel is not confident that it could get a security from any Palestinian state that comes in, and areas that they've withdrawn from, they've been attacked from afterwards. I don't put all the blame.
On a military stage, isn't Israel significantly more powerful than the Palestinians today, or what the Palestinians might even become in the next 10 years?
That's true, and that's true.
So doesn't that give them a sense of
security? That's true of the United States with regard to Al-Qaeda.
Right.
But I mean, in other words, asymmetry of power doesn't mean you feel safe. When Hamas fired missiles at Tel Aviv, the center of the Jewish people in Israel, that unified the country. I'm not trying to put all the blame on the Palestinians. Israelis have blame to share. There's blame to go around. I'm just telling you what the problem is.
Do you believe, because in the last hour we talked about, talked about growing Semitism, anti-Semitism in Western Europe, as it relates to the Muslims what's happening there, and the inability of many of them to assimilate to the Western European countries where they have immigrated. My question to you is, do you believe that, because you're very concerned about the growing threat of anti-Semitism, do you believe that the worldwide view of Israel as a victim in this case is shared by more or fewer people than it was 5 or 10 years ago? Is public opinion around the world moving against the state of Israel?
Public opinion has moved against Israel, and because Israel has committed the one irretrievable thing for sort of European intellectuals and left-wing intellectuals in the United States, it's strong. Israel, when it was weak before 1967, was beloved. Mourning dead Jews is something that's extremely popular. But the Israelis defending themselves but the big problem in Western Europe has been this union of the right, the left, and virtually all the strongly identified Muslims in Europe, which is a serious problem. Believe me, even before the last war, if you have Israeli speakers walking to a university in England, that person will be mobbed on the street, yelled at, things will be thrown at them. I know this. This is pretty nasty, and people in America should know it.
There's a man by the name of Norman Finkelstein. He's Jewish. He goes to European universities all the time, and none of that, what you're describing, happens to them.
Right. People who hate Israel, even if they're Jewish, often get by just fine.
When we come back, 1-800-723-8229, we'll let you respond to that comment, I assume, about Professor Finkelstein when we come back from Coast to Coast and Border to Border, live tonight from WBEZ Radio. That is on beautiful Navy Pier in downtown Chicago, or on the banks of Lake Michigan. Back shortly. Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border, on America's great talk radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. And wherever you're listening tonight, it's nice to have you with us. Khalil, you were upset with some things that were said in describing the growth of anti-Semitism. I'm trying to summarize your thoughts as to where you think this discussion tonight should go next. What has been missed in this discussion?
No, let me preface this by saying that I'm not an expert on anti-Semitism, but one of my friends the other day that I was talking to is, and what he was telling me is, the worst mistake that we as a people can commit, we the Jewish people can commit, is to conflate the anti-Semitism that we see amongst Muslims in Europe with the anti-Israel sentiment that exists in Europe. We should be careful to parse out the two, because he said, and I quote, and I'm quoting a private conversation that should never have gone public, as long as I don't give his name, that's fine. I quote that he said that it would be a disservice to the memory of those that we have lost in the Holocaust to conflate anti-Israel sentiments in Europe with anti-Semitism, the same anti-Semitism, he said, that killed millions of Jews in Europe.
I think that there's a lot to that. I want to be very serious now. In fact, I almost never talked about anti-Semitism until the last few years when I saw it coming up again in Europe. I just don't think it exists in any significant, politically significant way in the United States. And the fact that in the 1960s there were some clubs that didn't let Jews in, okay, but that's a kind of minor thing. There are two issues here. One is that there are a number of people who are not anti-Semitic at all who are anti-Israel in one form or another. I think that's absolutely right, what Khalil is saying. But there are other people who mask their anti-Semitism by simply saying it's anti-Israel. So when people are marching in the streets with send them to the gas chambers, those are easily identified. But others are not. And what you're seeing is Jews themselves voting with their feet in cities and in countries, France, parts of Sweden. You're seeing, by the way, gays are also feeling very jeopardized in some of these cities because they're not being tolerated. The second thing that's going on is that the Palestinian political movement, which is very strong on campuses, is all about, not about politics, it's about delegitimating the Jewish state. Remember when they say Palestine, Palestine must be free, the last part of that statement is from the Jordan River to the sea. That means Israel must be eliminated entirely. So I think that there are serious problems here, but I do take Khalil's point. There are many people who are not anti-Jewish who are anti-Israel, but there are a lot of people who are both.
Khalil, what about the destruction of Israel? As most would suggest, at least listening to this program this evening, we've certainly heard for years and years now that that is one of the things that the Palestinians want, that they would like to see Israel, you know, destroyed. Leaders of that part of the world have even said that publicly.
You're right. There are some Palestinians that want Israel, and I quote, pushed into the sea. There's all kinds of people that are unsavory, unprincipled, and they're just downright lousy and anti-Semitic. So I completely agree with
Charles.
How many
people are there? What percentage are we talking
about? You know, if I was to handicap it, I would say that less than 0.1% of the Palestinian population would choose the destruction of Israel over having a state of their own. Most Palestinians, if not all Palestinians, want to have the two-state solution so that they can live in two ways, free from occupation and free from the kind of military action that Israel has taken against them in recent years.
Let me ask you one question that might tease this out. If a leader in some of the Islamic countries across the Middle East were to say, I favor a two-state solution.
They all have.
A Palestinian state, let me continue, a Palestinian state and a Jewish state of Israel.
It's called the Arab Peace Initiative in 2002.
Where they say that Israel should be a Jewish state.
There's
what would happen to those political leaders?
Arab country, the 22 Arab countries that got together and drafted the Arab Peace Initiative, have basically said that they want an Israel and a Palestine living side by side in peace and security.
But they don't say
now,
that Israel can be a Jewish state. In fact, that's a sticking
because
point.
Because by definition, there's a lot of Israelis that would say we're not a Jewish state. We're a state that's liberal and multicultural.
No, we
have 1 million Arabs who are not
they
Jewish.
They don't mean to get rid of the Arabs,
and therefore,
but they
we
are
not
a Jewish
state. There is a lot of Israeli friends that I have that would deny that this is a Jewish state. They want to be a liberal, democratic state just like Holland and like the United States is.
Art Sir.
A state of all of its people.
Art Sir.
Let me try to lighten the atmosphere, but with a serious point. Charles made passing reference to prejudicial clubs in the U.S., which used to be everywhere. President John F. Kennedy, earlier in his tenure, had an unhappy staff member who told the president that he was shocked to find that he had not resigned from the stuffy Lynx Club in New York. He said, Mr. President, don't you know they don't admit Jews or Negroes? And Kennedy reportedly laughed and said, hell, Jews and Negroes, they don't admit Catholics. The degree to which we have become more tolerant in this country is quite remarkable. We had Kennedy deserves credit for that in the way he handled the Catholic issue in 60.
And women into these clubs. We remember, all of us here in Chicago, women were kept out.
You see, I just have to bring this up, and Charles immediately provides reinforcement for my point. The Middle East has not, we set a good example. That's important. The Middle East has not had a region-wide war for three decades.
Our program is now over. We have not solved the Arab, the Israeli,
we're just getting warmed down, Bruce.
We have not solved the expansionism of Russia, and we certainly haven't even touched the surface of what ISIS is doing, okay? So it means we're going to have something to talk about again next week. All right, thanks very much to our guests. Khalil Morar, thank you very much for being with us. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago, and Art Sear as well from Carthage College. Also, our thanks to Colin Bobbitt and Charles Upshaw and Claude Cunningham and Adam Yaffe, for their assistance in the production of this program, as well as to Dan Dorfman, our call screener, and, of course, the ever-popular Todd Neville. They all help make this program possible. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.